From NPR and WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Congressional Democrats are filling in the details of President Biden's coronavirus relief package. And one major idea is to send families $300 checks each month for every child in a family. If passed, this measure could cut the child poverty rate here in the U.S. in half. Joining us on Skype is Connecticut Democrat Rosa DeLauro. She's been advocating for this policy for almost two decades. And Congresswoman, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to join you, Tanya. It really is. Thank you.
Yes. Well, let's start with the basics. How would this plan work?
Well, you know, first of all, let me just say this. The United States is exceptional and admired for so many reasons, but not about cutting child poverty, ending child poverty. And the child poverty issue has only been made dramatically worse by the coronavirus. So today, with the what we will finally do is to address this failure in the president's package in the rescue plan. And this, the rescue plan is for 1 year, and it expands the child tax credit and work to cut child poverty in half. How does it work? In other words, we will expand the current child tax credit, because there is a current child tax credit. That is at $2,000. However, one third of children in the United States, mostly Black children and Hispanic children, have been left out because their families don't make enough money. They are rural families, families on minimum wage, families of veterans, families which have a large number of children. So what the Family Act, which is part of the rescue plan, will do is to then include all of these children who are currently not eligible. Further, for children who are under 6 years old, it'll be $3,600 per child. And for those 6 to 17, it will be $3,000.
Well, let me ask you this. Yes, Congresswoman, the big objection to this is cost, more than $120 billion a year. This price tag actually gave Hillary Clinton pause back in 2016 when she was running for president, and she backed away from it. What are you hearing from other Democrats who are nervous about this cost?
Well, they're not. I mean, I don't know what gives you the impression that they are nervous. It's $117 billion, but when you take a look at being able to cut child poverty in half, providing families with the wherewithal to take care of their health care costs, their food costs, their housing costs, that in fact we are looking at something that in the long term is of a great benefit to the economy.
And let me ask you something else. I want to ask you one thing about one Republican, Senator Mitt Romney, has put forward a similar plan for cash benefits each month, but this plan would cut other social benefits like food stamps to pay for this. Are you willing to negotiate the details to get more support?
No.
No, you're not.
No, but I will tell you that I'm welcome Senator Romney to the conversation. And I think we need to, you know, to talk about what he's talking about. But the fact is that he is looking at his plan is said to cut child poverty by about 32.5%. But it appears that it costs less. And it only goes through 2025. Reports have said incorrectly that it is permanent. He caps the amount of money so larger families don't get the credit. So welcoming to the debate. But overall, because what we announced today was the introduction of the American Family Act, which would make what we're doing permanent. As I said, the president's rescue plan is for 1 year. We need to make this permanent. And if we do that, then we are really doing what Social Security did. Would anyone change Social Security? It lifted 90% of seniors out of poverty. This piece of legislation has the ability to lift millions of children and their families out of poverty. That's what the direction should be. We need to build that architecture for the future in lifting half of African-American kids, 40% of Hispanic kids, 40% of white children, 61% of Native American children, and also about 40% of Asian American kids as well.
Congresswoman, thank you so much. I appreciate this. You've been working on this for 2 decades, as we said. Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, a Democrat from Connecticut.
Coronavirus vaccinations are steadily increasing in the United States. Almost 10% of the population has gotten at least one dose so far. But there's pressure to speed up vaccinations because new, more contagious variants are spreading. In South Africa, health officials stopped distributing the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine because it doesn't appear to work well against a variant of COVID-19 first discovered there. Let's look at what all this means with Dr. Tom Inglesby. He directs the Center for Health Security at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Dr. Inglesby, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So what can you tell us about this COVID-19 variant in South Africa and what studies show about how effective vaccines are against it?
The South African variant, or the variant that was first found in South Africa, we should say, we don't know if it started there, but in any event, that's where it was discovered, does look like it is both more transmissible and, at least for the AstraZeneca vaccine and for the J&J vaccine, looks like it may be less effective at preventing mild to moderate disease, which is concerning. And it shows us that variants are going to continue to be a problem in the world and that we have to track them very closely and track them against our medicines and our vaccines very closely. But the good news, if there is any, or at least the less concerning news, is that for the J&J vaccine, it does look like it protected against severe disease and death for the South Africa strain. So that remains encouraging.
Yeah, that is good news. And that's one of the vaccines that appears to be on the horizon. The AstraZeneca vaccine has not yet been approved by the FDA for use in the U.S. And the Johnson & Johnson vaccine that you just mentioned is now going to be reviewed by the FDA for emergency use. And that could come this week. So if it does, what would that mean for the vaccination effort?
I think it would be a huge benefit to the vaccination effort in the United States and ultimately around the world. Johnson & Johnson says it can make on the order of 1 billion doses a year, and it's a single-use vaccine and doesn't require unusual freezers. So if we could bring this online as part of the U.S. vaccination effort, that'll be a huge addition.
A key difference, right? Because some of these earlier vaccines have required a lot of maintenance at very low temperatures to work. And maybe that's part of the reason why the rollout has been kind of rocky. We are up to now about 1.4 million shots being given in a day. Is that enough, or do we need to ramp up even further, Dr. Inglesby?
Well, first of all, I think we should just acknowledge that this is the most complicated and most urgent and most rapid mass vaccination effort in U.S. history. So this is a huge enterprise, very, very daunting for the country to take this on. I think in the last couple of days, there have been 2.2 million doses given out per day around the country. That compares to mid-January, we were giving out 500,000, 600,000 doses a day. So it is moving in the right direction. I think more and more vaccination channels are coming online. Pharmacies are going to be coming online in about a week with their own vaccine supply. So I think we do need to get faster, and I think we will get faster. And Johnson & Johnson hopefully will help us do that.
Should the people who have been vaccinated continue to wear their masks and keep social distancing? And if so, I mean, do you think that that could actually deter some people from lining up to get vaccinated because they see maybe a little incentive to get the shot without that instant gratification of getting their lives back to normal?
So the answer is people should continue to wear masks, absolutely, and practice social distancing. And that's for a couple of reasons. First of all, the vaccines aren't perfect. They are very, very good vaccines as compared to other vaccines that we take. They're very effective so far. But still, there are some people who won't get perfect protection. It's also unclear yet whether people who are vaccinated and don't get sick can still carry the virus. So if we wear masks, we're less likely to transmit it to someone else who hasn't been vaccinated yet. So I think we should continue to see it as both helping ourselves prevent infection as well as our civic duty to try and prevent others from getting infected from us.
And presumably then when everyone or close to everyone is vaccinated, then perhaps we can get back to something closer to normal. But until then, as you say, think of yourself and others in the meantime. Last thing, Dr. Inglesby, I'm curious because we finally saw some encouraging statistics at the federal level. And then granted, they are sometimes lower on Sundays, but there were about 87,000 new cases of COVID-19. yesterday, and that was the first time since early November that we dipped under the 100,000 mark. So do you see that as kind of a one-off, or do you see some encouragement there that the number of cases are going to keep declining?
It's definitely encouraging and more than a one-off. This has been going on now for many weeks. Cases have been steadily declining. Hospitalizations have been declining a little bit less quickly than case numbers, but still on the decline. We're hopeful that the numbers of people dying will also begin to go down. And I think people also, it's possible people are appropriately worried about the new variants that they're reading about and are trying to take, you know, physical distancing very seriously. And hopefully a combination of things are happening. They're helping us drive case numbers down around the country, and that trend continues.
Yeah, if people are concerned and redoubling their efforts to abide by those social distancing and hand washing and mask wearing protocols, that's probably a good thing. Dr. Tom Inglesby directs the Center for Health Security at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Dr. Inglesby, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
There are these passages in the new book, Three Mothers, that reframe historical moments about some of the most iconic civil rights leaders. For instance, we learn the details of an excited Alberta king traveling to Norway to see her son, Martin Luther, accept the Nobel Peace Prize. Or that time James Baldwin's mother, Burtis, helped him work through one of the characters of his now very well-known play, Blues for Mr. Charlie. Author Anna Malaika Tubbs makes the case in her new book that knowing these stories helps us better understand America. She joined us on Skype to talk more about the three mothers, how the mothers of Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, and James Baldwin shaped a nation. And we started off our conversation talking about the context in which these women lived.
When I started the research, I first went to the books that were about the men. That was kind of my starting point. And I quickly realized that the parts of their life that were the least documented were before they met their husbands and before they had their sons. So before in history, where this man makes them important. And so I spent really a lot of time finding this historic context, really weaving together the details of all the different places where they came from and the places that they lived and what they cared about. Each of these moments would influence them differently based off their own access to resources, their own education levels, Jim Crow laws, two world wars, the Cold War. I wanted us to explore Black history and American history through the eyes of Black women, Black girls, Black mothers.
Well, let's talk about these mothers individually. Let's start with Louise Little, Malcolm X's mother. She was born in Grenada, met Malcolm's father in Canada. They traveled the country teaching the Marcus Garvey Doctrine of Black Independence. But yes, after Malcolm's father was killed, Louise was deemed unfit to care for her children, and she was sent to a mental institution for 25 years of her life.
She is constantly the victim of these racist attacks, and it's not by coincidence. A big part of it is that she's very outspoken. She is this radical activist even before she meets her husband. And even after her husband passes, she wants to stay involved. She wants to provide for her children on her own. But she's not given the life insurance money that she deserves. She also then faces what many women of color over the years have spoken about, which is the invasive nature of welfare workers and this feeling that you're being judged when you're receiving the aid and the care that you're supposed to have available to you. And so there's a white male doctor who is instrumental in sending her to the institution, and I include the letter verbatim in the book where he says she's maladjusted, she's had a change in personality. He judges her for having her eighth child, and he ends by saying, quote unquote, that she's imagining being discriminated against. The craziness of saying about a Black woman from a white man that she's imagining being discriminated against. But this is enough to put her away for 25 years of her life because her family members were all her children. So they were too young to be able to advocate for her. Therefore, again, she's put away against her will.
I want to talk with you about Burtis Baldwin, the mother of James Baldwin. And we learned that these two were extremely close in your book. One educator at James's school when he was a child actually commented that Burtis's beautiful use of language, they all understood that James Baldwin got that from his mother. Your
yes.
telling of Burtis's story in a way gives us a fuller picture of the world that James Baldwin shared with us through his writing. I mean, it actually helps complete the picture.
Yes, and that's what I want to accomplish with the book. I have a lot of goals for the book. That's definitely one of them, is that we have a fuller appreciation of these men. It's not to say that we need to erase the men, but when we do erase the mothers and we leave them out of the story, we don't fully understand how these men came to be who they were and how they changed our world for the better. And each of these sons credited their moms. There's letters and quotes from them where they say, "It's because of my mom that I was able to do this." And I would say the clearest example of that comes with James Baldwin. Even when he passes away, his kind of dying wish is that he has a grave next to him. It's a double plot where his mother will join him when she passes. She has eight other children. But when he dies, he knows that people are going to want to come and see his grave. And they're going to know that his mother is interconnected with him, that they are inextricable from each other's lives. He was well aware of it. And it's just time that the rest of the world is, too.
Anna, we also get glimpses of Malcolm and James and Martin through a mother's eyes. One story that tickled me was of a little Martin begging his mother to allow him to go to school when he wasn't even old enough yet.
I love that story as well. I think it's so cute, and how she, you know, actually agrees that she'll do this for him. And it takes a teacher noticing that he's too young and sending him home. But how he carries forward this feeling that my mom believed in me, and that's all he really needed. With Malcolm X, one of my favorite stories is how much he loved growing peas. A big part of being this Marcus Garvey follower is that you believe in self-sufficiency. And so Louise and Earl taught their children how to hunt and plant their own food. And Malcolm speaks to growing his peas and then laying on the ground next to them and dreaming of his future, just staring at the sky. And I just find that to be so beautiful. And then with James Baldwin, I just picture him with each of his siblings, you know, he's helping to take care of them, and he sees himself as his mother's right-hand man because he really has this deep resentment of his stepfather, who is abusive towards him, abusive towards his mother, and he decides that in order to help her through that, he's just going to be by her side. And you just see with these three boys, their love for their moms, their dependence on their moms, as well as their mom's ability to be honest and vulnerable with their sons as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk about Alberta King, MLK's mother. She was raised in Atlanta. Her father was a preacher. Before marriage, we learned that she wanted to become a teacher, but laws prevented married women from teaching.
Yeah, terrible.
Yeah, I mean, that is what I mean by the context that you give in this book. We learn about the time that they were living in. Here's a clip from radio reporter Eleanor Fisher's 1961 interview with MLK, where he's talking about the role of the black mother in America, including his own. Let's listen.
It seems to me that the only thing that the mother can do, the Negro mother, is try from the beginning to instill in the child a sense of somebodiness. This was what my mother tried to do. She made it very clear that in spite of these conditions, you are as good as anybody else, and you must not feel that you are not.
I mean, Anna, it's almost like that's the full-time job of a black mother. But we learned from your book that throughout his life, Martin consulted with his mother on just about everything. And one of the most horrific parts of her story is that she was deeply afraid her son would be killed. And Martin really didn't try to protect her from that possibility. Can you read the excerpt of when King went to his mother to have this conversation about death?
Okay. After dinner at the King household one night, as they sat on their patio and watched the sunset, Martin turned toward Alberta and said, "Mother, there are some things I want you to know." He continued, "There's a chance, Mother, that someone is going to try to kill me, and it could happen without any warning at all. But I don't want you to worry over any of this." He came closer to her side. "I have to go on with my work, no matter what happens now, because my involvement is too complete to stop."
Anna, it's a sobering fact that all three of these mothers outlived their sons.
Yes, and it's the tragedy that we know and start the book with, and then you see their lives develop. And it's all a part of painting their humanity so that we feel it, so that we cry in ways that we might not have in just hearing of the history.
Was that the case for you? I know that you're a new mother.
personally, that chapter, obviously, where I talk about the sons all passing away, I had to distance myself from it. As much as I felt connected to their three stories, I also felt inspired by their ability to not give up, to know that in this country, their children were going to be viewed differently. And I'm well aware of that for my own child. But they were also so clear that they were going to be part of that change and that their children were going to help transform systems around them. I see it as something that we need to stop looking at as some kind of inevitable lot for Black women to carry, as if we're supernatural and can stand more pain than other people. I want this book to be about changing that circumstance. What are the policies that we can put in place to make sure that we're on a different trajectory and we can reduce the loss in our Black communities?
Anna, recently we re-aired a conversation my colleague Michelle Martin had with the late Cicely Tyson. And Tyson told her a story about her role in the movie Sounder. It was a story about a Black family and their love for each other. And Tyson says during a press junket, she heard that a lot of white people didn't know Black children called their parents mommy and daddy. Do you think at the root, this kind of mythology is why it's only now that we're examining the lives of women like this?
We have to reckon with the fact over and over again that this country was built by slaves, and it was built by saying that we Black people were not people. We were property. You know, Black mothers in America are the only ones who have legally been deemed the givers of property. When we can confront that dehumanizing treatment, when we can confront how that is playing a role in mass incarceration, in the Black maternal health crisis, and so much more, that's when we're able to move forward and say, what can we put in place to recognize humanity? That's where it all comes back to. I do hope my book contributes to that. It's about more people recognizing who we are as human beings.
Anna Malaika Tubbs, her new book is The Three Mothers: How the Mothers of Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, and James Baldwin Shaped a Nation. Anna, thank you so much for your work.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. I really appreciate the support.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Tuesday, February 9th from noon to 1 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
How do we reinvent ourselves? And what's the secret to living longer? I'm Anoush Zomorodi. Each week on NPR's TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey with TED speakers to seek a deeper understanding of the world and to figure out new ways to think and create. Listen now.
There are two types of people who watch the Super Bowl: those there for the game and those watching for the commercials. Historically, the interest in this yearly ad extravaganza is less about consumerism, even though each spot costs about $5.5 million. That's for 30 seconds. And most is about the art of the sell. And this year, it was all about keeping it light, with less emphasis on the moment we're in. And for more, let's check in with Here and Now media analyst John Carroll. John, welcome.
Hi.
John, before we get to some of the big ads, there were some notable Super Bowl fixtures that were not part of this blitz. What brands chose to skip this year?
Well, outside of the Kansas City Chiefs, the major no-shows this year ranged from Hyundai and Kia to Coke and Pepsi. The biggest no-show, though, was Budweiser. The flagship brand of Anheuser-Busch has been in the Super Bowl for the last 37 years. They sat out this year, donating some of their ad budget to a nonprofit group that's trying to overcome vaccine hesitancy amid the coronavirus pandemic.
And John, I caught that dig right there on the Chiefs. You know, a big theme this year was about identity and claiming space in America. This year's Tecate beer ad, for instance, spoke specifically to Mexican Americans and their Mexico is in us ad. And Logitech, which sells computer accessories like microphones and webcams, feature the rapper Lil Nas X in their ad on digital creativity. Let's take a listen.
Stand there in defiance. That's right. We the makers. We the groundbreakers. We the creators.
What other ads like this did you see?
There was a lot of diversity in the ads this year. The Indeed ad was sort of a United Nations of diversity. It had all kinds of different people, and it played against stereotypes, which was really interesting to see.
Yeah, and the NFL actually put in an ad of their own, shots of Black Lives Matter protesters, football players with Breonna Taylor and Eric Gardner written on their helmets. Let's listen.
Football is a microcosm of America. All races, religions, living.
And this ad ends with the NFL pledging $250 million to help end systemic racism. But there's a lot of chatter on social that this was disingenuous, to say the least, considering that former quarterback Colin Kaepernick is still a free agent after he was blacklisted when he took a knee during the anthem to protest police killings in 2016. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, that money is not nothing, but the NFL can't really buy its way out of this situation. I think what they need to do is show action rather than just throw money at the problem.
Mm-hmm. From your view, did the more lighthearted tone overall, though, strike the right balance in light of our current moment with the pandemic and political unrest?
Yeah, I think if you look at the USA Today ad meter ratings, most of the top 10 are humorous ads. Will Ferrell for GM going after Norway over electric cars. And I think people were looking for as much escapism as they could get. So there was a lot of nostalgia, giving people a sense that things are normal when they really aren't.
Mm-hmm. That was John Carroll, Here and Now's media analyst on this year's Super Bowl ads. John, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The country's third largest school district may be reopening soon. The governing body of the Chicago Teachers Union will vote today on a tentative agreement with the mayor to reopen public schools for in-person classes. Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot unveiled the deal yesterday. The union calls it a framework, months into a bitter fight over how to reopen schools in the middle of a pandemic. WBEZ's Sarah Karp is in Chicago with the latest. Sarah, under this potential solution, students in pre-K and some special education students would return later this week. Many others would return next month. What else is in the agreement?
So some of the biggest things that the union and the school district were at odds over was about which teachers and staff should be allowed to work from home. So there was a lot of debate about whether people who live in a household with a person that's medically compromised should be allowed to work from home. The union said yes, that they shouldn't, you know, risk having to bring the virus into their house. But the school district was sort of in a bad situation because in order to open schools, you actually need staff and teachers in those schools. So this is it's sort of a detailed compromise, but there is an allowance for people who have who live in a household with somebody who's medically compromised to get vaccinated actually within the next 2 weeks. So they have to agree to be vaccinated in the next 2 weeks, and then they have to agree to come back when they're supposed to come back, either depending on what grade level, because they're coming in at different times. And if they don't, then they have to take an unpaid leave of absence, but with benefits and job protections. So there is a compromise around that, but that was really a very big issue around the table.
I see. Delicate, to say the least. And so once we get to going back to in-school learning, if this deal is approved, what percentage of kids are likely to return? And do we know what the school day will look like for them?
So this is just a hybrid plan. It's where, you know, kids come in 2 days a week, and then the other 3 days they continue to learn from home. And only about a third of all elementary school students are expected to come back. And actually, they can't change their mind now because their parents were asked to do a survey in December, and the school district said that if you have to declare right then and there whether you're wanting to come back. So it's only a third, so it's about 60, 7,000 students out of about 190,000 elementary school students that were offered in-person learning.
Got it. And as we say, it would ramp up. We're looking at kids in fifth grade and younger. That's sort of the focus. When will their parents and the teachers, for that matter, Sarah, know for sure whether the deal is approved and whether this plan is a go?
So tonight, the House of Delegates, which is the governing body of the Chicago Teachers Union, they'll decide whether to pass the agreement on to membership to vote to ratify. So this is usually sort of a perfunctory, you know, thing that happens, but they will decide whether they want to send it with a recommendation to pass, with a recommendation to reject, or just neutral. And then the members will vote over the next couple days, you know, probably electronically since they're, you know, out, they're still remote. And then we should find out, you know, I don't know if they'll do it over one day. If they were in person, they'd probably do it over one day. But I'm not exactly sure since it's electronic, if it'll take 2 days or 3 days.
Sure. It sounds a bit like tracking a bill through Congress,
right,
frankly.
Right.
So there's
a lot
still to watch.
Right.
That's WBEZ's Sarah Karp in Chicago with the latest on the plan to reopen schools in that city. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You might think every child in this country has the constitutional right to read, right? Well, a group of parents and students in Detroit claimed their education was so inadequate they could barely read, and that violates their 14th Amendment rights. They sued the state of Michigan, and last May, a federal court ruled in their favor, saying kids have a right to a basic minimum education, a chance to become literate. It's the first time a federal court has asserted that right, and soon after, the state of Michigan settled its case with the families. But Andrea Thompson, one of the seven parents who sued, says this fight is far from over. She recently wrote an op-ed about this for the nonprofit news publication Bridge Michigan, and she joins us now from Detroit on Skype. Andrea, welcome.
Thank you for having me here today. I really appreciate it.
Yes, thank you for being here, Andrea. I want us to talk more about the settlement with the state of Michigan and what you're asking for, but first I'd like for you to tell us about your son, Antonio. This lawsuit had been going on for 4 years before it was settled. Since then, he's graduated from high school. But how would you describe his education in the Detroit Public School District?
He did not receive a good education in the Detroit Public School System due to, number one, in the wintertime, it was freezing cold. In the summertime, it could get up to like 100 degrees. I mean, in the spring. So how can kids sit in a class where it's 100 degrees and no air conditioning? They can barely breathe. And there's no books in the class. It may be like three books. The books are over 20 years old. They closed out the special ed classes. So now the special ed children are merged into general ed with no special ed aid. My son was in classroom where it wasn't enough desk in the room. It was times they would send his academic class down to the gym and let the coach babysit three and four classes. We couldn't get teachers to come work at such an under-resourced school. My son was miserable. He was miserable. And so it's just unfortunate that in America, zip codes matter when it comes to an education, and it shouldn't.
What made you go from being a frustrated parent to actually suing?
Well, in 2016, when we were on break, the teachers and I, the educators, we were watching the news and we seen the Flint water crisis. And we seen that Darnell Early, the emergency manager that was over the Flint water crisis, was the same emergency manager over Detroit Public Schools at that time. And so a number of teachers started to organize and bring all of us together. We shut down 97 schools. From there, lawyers came to Detroit and they said what was happening to our children was a crime.
Under this settlement offer, Governor Gretchen Whitmer has agreed to do a couple of things, including sending an additional $2.7 million to Detroit schools. But your op-ed has some additional asks, and I want to go through some of them. You want to see contemporary books and resources across the board for Detroit students, a closing of the digital divide, so that means that all students have computers and internet access, and you want a new curricula that includes African-American literature and history. Andrea, I can't help but think that these are pretty basic asks. Are you saying that kids in Detroit aren't getting these basic resources?
Yes. When I first talked to Mark Rosenbaum, he looked at me and said, what's happening to your child is a crime. And the first thing that came out of my mouth, because I had suffered from mommy guilt, I'm still suffering from mommy guilt, is that I didn't know, because it had became normal to us what was happening here. And it also caused a lot of crime in the school to prison pipeline, because if a child cannot read, they cannot fill out a job application. You cannot be a janitor if you cannot read the labels on the solutions to mix. You cannot vote. You cannot even get a driver's license if you cannot read. So it caused an increase in violence because young people found themselves in the streets without being able to read and without being employable.
And Mark Rosenbaum was your attorney for the Right to Literacy lawsuit. What are you and other parents doing to ensure that the state actually follows through with their promises?
So I have been building power and organizing since then. I have a ladies entrepreneur empowerment circle. It's over 5,000 Black women entrepreneurs in the city of Detroit. And we are organized not only to build wealth in our families and communities, but also to demand a better education for our children.
Your son, Antonio, is now 21 years old. How has this experience impacted his life and your family?
It has significantly impacted his mental health, his emotional, because he was exposed to a lot of things he shouldn't have been exposed to. He didn't get the proper education to be able to, go to the college of his dream. But he just has a lot of trauma he has to heal from. And so I'm allowing him to do that.
That's Andrea Thompson, a Detroit mother who joined six other families to sue the state of Michigan over the right to read. Andrea, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Microban 24 doesn't just sanitize and stop. It keeps killing bacteria for 24 hours.
You may have caught that ad for P&G's Microban cleaning product during the Super Bowl last night. And while we can't say whether the claims are true, we can say it was a reminder of the billions of dollars worldwide spent on cleaning products in the last year. Even though, as our next guest points out, research shows COVID-19 is mostly spread through the air and rarely via surfaces. Derek Thompson is a staff writer at The Atlantic and joins us now from Washington, as he does every Monday. Hi, Derek.
Hi there.
So fill in the details. I mean, what does research say about how likely a person is to catch the virus off a surface?
The very simple upshot of that question is that it's not particularly likely that people catch this virus from surfaces, or what researchers sometimes call fomites. It is much more likely that they will catch it from breathing. This is mostly an airborne virus. That means that it tends to spread from the microscopic spittle that is emitted from our mouths when we breathe heavily, when we talk, especially talk loudly, when we sing, and certainly when we shout. And the most dangerous places to be with this virus is where you're around other people who are talking, especially talking loudly or otherwise exertedly exhaling in a closed, unventilated space. For whatever reason, and there's no real need to speculate deeply here, this is a disease, a virus that has evolved to spread very efficiently through the air and not very efficiently on the ground. And so this piece that I've written, which is the second piece I've written about so-called hygiene theater, is about how we are misguided in thinking about this disease as a land war when we should really think of it as an aerial war against an airborne virus.
Well, I like the point of clarification that you have in the piece. It's so good, I just have to quote it. You write that the fact the coronavirus is much less likely to spread through surfaces does not mean that it is impossible to get the virus from touching things. If somebody with COVID-19 sneezes three times onto a little spot on a cold steel table and you rub your hand around in the snot for a bit and immediately lick your fingers, that disgusting act may well result in you infecting yourself. I mean, first of all, chef's kiss on the writing there, Derek. But I think the point is that you're seeing this so-called hygiene theater. What's the problem with that?
Great question. And this is the question that I get from everyone who reads this piece and someone disagrees with it. They say, what's the problem if I just want to wash my hands nine times a day? Well, look, besides maybe developing a bit of eczema on your outer palm, nothing really. But the costs of hygiene theater really are greater than just dry hands for paranoid people. urban transit authorities in New York, in Boston, and abroad are spending hundreds of millions of dollars blasting their subways and buses with antimicrobial weaponry, and it's not particularly clear this does anything. Sometimes they shut down trains or shut down buses in order to do this. That means people can't get to work because we're busy scrubbing surfaces that don't need the scrubbing. Second, I think it really builds a false sense of security. If you're thinking about going into a gym, into a restaurant, into some other closed, unventilated space, and the thing that encourages you to go in there is that you see someone really soaping down a table or an elliptical equipment, and you go in and you're not particularly careful because you think that the problem's been solved with the use of soap, you're just wrong. You are acting based on a false sense of security that says that the way to fight this disease is by scrubbing and not by ventilating. So, you know, if people want to wash their hands, that's fantastic. And every single scientist that I've talked to has said people should wash their hands during a pandemic, of course. But hygiene theater is when institutions and authorities and companies take this so far and convince people that this is all about fomites and surfaces and not about what's going on in the air above them.
Well, and to your point, I mean, people only have so much bandwidth to focus on so many things. You want to be sure they're focusing on the right things. So if it's the mask wearing and the hand washing that's more effective than the wiping down surfaces, you want to have the focal point in the right spot. I'm wondering, though, Derek, I mean, we all read research early on in the pandemic about how long viruses can live on surfaces. I think that's what sort of fueled this, you know, sanitize everything craze. So was there some problem with that research?
I think there was a problem with the research. I think a lot of the papers stacked the deck in order to provide a kind of spa-like environment for this virus to maximize its survival. Often they would use unrealistic conditions. They would use samples that had several orders of magnitude more virus than that which is emitted from a simple cough or sneeze. They used optimal temperature and humidity. They basically treated the virus as carefully as possible to show that it could live as long as possible on surfaces. The metaphor that occurred to me after I wrote this article is, you know, imagine if you wanted to prove as a scientist that mangoes can easily grow in Vermont. Well, they can't, first of all. But let's say you really wanted to show that. Maybe you'd build a $1 billion greenhouse, grow exactly one mango, and then show the world, hey, look, I grew a mango in Vermont with a $1 billion greenhouse. This is the sort of impact that these kind of studies are having. They're designing extremely unrealistic environments that privilege the virus survival, and that has the effect of scaring people about surfaces when we should be overwhelmingly obsessed with airborne spread disease.
Got it. Well, Derek Thompson from The Atlantic, thank you as always for joining us and setting the record straight on viral surfaces.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Callum Borchers.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.